The following program is produced by the University of Florida's School of Journalism and Communications under a grant from the National Educational Television and Radio Center in cooperation with the National Association of Educational Broadcasters.
The struggle for democracy in Latin America is very complicated by the fact that Latin America, as a whole, has never gotten over the inheritance of the colonial period in its history.
The situation in the concentration camp is terrible. They have forced labor. Then they give physical punishment. Well, this is the real situation in Paraguay.
The University of Florida presents The Struggle for Democracy, the third in a series of recorded documentary reports on the contemporary revolution in Latin America. Your reporter is the distinguished American journalist and editor of the Christian Science Monitor, Erwin D. Canham.
The struggle for democracy in Latin America began with the Wars of Independence during the first quarter of the 19th century. The struggle continues today. The United States can no longer sit back and view this struggle for self-government by its neighbors with the same old indifference. For the specter of the Cold War has permeated the issues, and the failure of democracy in Latin America may well mean the loss of most of Central and South America and the Caribbean to the communist bloc. Western democracy is on trial in Latin America.
The real problem of Latin America is these oligarchies that try to stop progress. There has to be economic development and there has to be social justice, and this will not be done by the present-day oligarchies with whom the U.S. has been playing ball. It will either be done by the liberal parties that are democratic and pro-West, or it will be done by the international communist movement. This is being proved every day.
A pessimistic report from the former president of Costa Rica, Jose Figueres.
We believe, and by I mean the liberal parties of Latin America, we believe that it can be done and it must be done. The transformation of Latin America has to take place in our time. The difference is that other people want to do it in an alliance with the Russians and the Chinese. And still other people, the oligarchies, do not want it done at all. That's where we are in the middle. I'm sure that the net balance will be much more favorable for our peoples if we follow the democratic line. But I'm not sure that we can at the present moment. I think that the international forces that work against us have become too strong, and unless there is a concerted effort by all the Latin American republics, and especially by the United States as the leader of the Western world, I don't believe that we can stop the tide. Latin America, incredibly, is going the side of Russia and China, no matter what few ties we have with them, geographical, historical, cultural. Sounds preposterous, but that's the way things are going. I'm very sorry to report.
Most students of Latin American affairs blame the influence of colonial Spain for establishment of conditions unfavorable to the flowering of democracy.
The struggle for democracy in Latin America is very complicated by the fact that Latin America, as a whole, has never gotten over the inheritance of the colonial period in its history.
Harry Cantor is a political scientist at the University of Florida who taught the past academic year in San Jose, Costa Rica.
Unfortunately for Latin America, when the Spaniards came to the area, they overcame the military opposition of the Indians and set up a society in which a small group of basically Spaniards ruled a vast mass of Indians. Through the generations and the centuries which have passed since then, this idea that a small group, an aristocracy, is entitled to dominate the political, social, economic, religious life of the people has so permeated certain sections of society that democracy has had a very, very hard struggle to become established.
Latin American scholars are quick to point out a relationship in certain countries between the rate of illiteracy and the existence of dictatorships. Director of Hispanic Studies at Stanford University, Ronald Hilton, raised this point at the 10th Conference on the Caribbean.
And there's a relationship between literacy and dictatorship. The struggle going on today in Latin America between dictatorship and democracy is closely related to the problem of literacy, and it's not surprising to find that the countries where you find dictatorships are precisely the countries where you find illiteracy. I wouldn't suggest that literacy immediately brings democracy. There isn't that kind of a correlation, but there is the other correlation, I'm more or less convinced.
Permanent Secretary of the Superior Council on Education at the University of Puerto Rico, Ismael Rodriguez Bo, elaborates.
Dictatorships in our part of the world are notorious for the meagerness of their budgets for education and the lavishness of their expenditures for instruments of war and oppression. I asked the commanding general of a military establishment why almost all the soldiers were illiterates. His answer was prompt. When we want soldiers, we go to the rural areas and recruit them. The more illiterate and unpolished, the better. When we order them to shoot, they fire without questioning. Fortunately, this dictatorship is over by now. Others, as brutal, are still on the saddle. Few things have hurt the relationship between the United States and Latin America more than the diplomatic warm hand to dictators and the cold hand to liberals and democratic leaders.
Well, first thing, I don't think that this government is in any position to be criticized because we have not broken off relationships with some of these dictatorships.
Florida's junior senator, George Smathers.
I think it's unrealistic, dreamy, visionary, and completely impractical for a lot of people, dreamy people who get the idea that you can have the kind of a democracy in Haiti that we have in Florida, when you stop to remember that the per capita income in Haiti today is less than $47 per year per person. The illiteracy rate is 87% of the people. Now, Duvalier does not run a dictatorship, but you have to have a strong man because you just cannot operate a government on a democratic basis unless you have a high level of education. So I think it's a matter of being realistic. What are the facts? And the facts are that that they're making progress in Nicaragua. The facts are that Stroessner in Paraguay, I presume, is making progress there. I've never been to that country. I don't know him. But I hear that most of his people are direct Indian descent, that they are uneducated, that they have not had any opportunity. And he's trying to bring about a slowly developing economy for them and give them more opportunities than they have previously had.
This is Jules Dubois, Latin American correspondent of the Chicago Tribune. Well, Senator Smathers has a right to his opinion, no matter how erroneous it may be. I do not agree with him that Stroessner, for example, is a necessary evil because of illiteracy in Paraguay. Senator Smathers probably overlooks the fact that there are 400,000 Paraguayans in exile across the river in Argentina, and a large number of them in Buenos Aires, and they surely are not illiterates. The same holds true in other places. Haiti, for example, Duvalier is not a necessary evil because of the illiteracy of the Haitian people. The Haitian people have lived good lives under better governments.
If indeed a country's illiteracy rate is a strong indicator of the prevalence of a dictatorship, then Paraguay fits the formula. Illiteracy among the people, mostly Indians or mixed bloods, hovers around 80% in a country where political democracy has been virtually unknown. Conditions in Paraguay in recent years have been an open invitation to the military to take over the reins of government. This has been done in the traditional pattern of caudillismo, bossism, the rule of a military-backed strongman. A Paraguayan of part German descent, General Alfredo Stroessner, is such a strong man. He seized power in 1954 with the aid of the army garrison in Asunción, the capital. Despite growing opposition from all sides, he has ruled firmly ever since. What are conditions like in Paraguay under Stroessner's regime? Recorded somewhere in Central America, an exile from Paraguay, one of hundreds of thousands who have fled the regime of General Alfredo Stroessner.
Concentration camps in Paraguay are one in the Chaco jungle and one in Isla Margarita is a concentration camp for military and political, and one between Asunción is the capital, is Tacumbú is the name. The situation in this concentration camp is terrible. They have forced labor. Then they give physical punishment. Well, this is the real situation in Paraguay. I think that the United States ambassador, he can know, can investigate, but maybe can inform directly to the State Department. Well, I don't know, it's possible to. Paraguay, we have 1 million and 500,000. This is the population in Paraguay. And outside Paraguay, we have 400,000 people in exile. I say exile in Argentina, 400,000. This is the real situation in Paraguay.
The often wide divergence between the principles of constitutional democracy and the day-to-day practice of this most sophisticated of all forms of government has resulted in a certain cynicism in Latin America as well as in this country. In all fairness, the Latinos, if one reads their constitutions, are committed in theory to democracy. And besides, the road to true democracy has never been known to be a smooth one. Disaster may lie just around the next bend. Despite all obstacles, however, democratic forces in Latin America do drive forward. A case in point is Colombia. Here is a country that within the past decade has put to an end a disastrous, bloody civil war, has overthrown a dictator, restored order for the most part, and is leading the people toward the goal of fuller constitutional democracy. Storm clouds, however, are gathering over the republic. The next presidential election could lead to a crisis for democracy and to the collapse of the National Front. President Alberto Lleras Camargo presides over a unique coalition government, a strange, precarious alliance of the two traditional political parties, the conservatives and the liberals.
Todo esto se ha hecho con el objeto de aliviar la lucha política por una parte.
A leader of the Liberal Party of Colombia, Germán Zaya, now at the United Nations, explains how this unique experiment in bipartisan government came about.
The reason for this getting together of the parties was, first of all, to ease the political tension and political strife which had become acute, but also to get together all of the best brains of the country and get them to put aside for a moment the extremes of their political positions and reach agreement on the basic questions facing the country. The Liberal Party took a major part in the preparation of this agreement. The now President Lleras, although he had been head of the Liberal Party, has fulfilled the pact most faithfully. The Liberal Party today supports this government of national unity, but there is a small group within the Liberals who do not agree, particularly in relation to the alternation of the presidency. This minority holds that the people should be free to choose the president that they want without regard to party and not be obliged to choose first a liberal and then a conservative and so on.
One of the liberals who does not want to see the principle of alternation between the parties continue and is not willing to have the presidency automatically revert in 1962 to the conservatives is the son of a former Colombian president. Dr. Alfonso López Miquelson represents a new breed of Latin American politician, a man of wealth who, contrary to his background, champions left-tinged causes. Some observers see in Dr. López Miquelson a demagogue who seeks to gain politically if and when he can topple the National Front. In turn, he sees himself as representing a group who regard this alternation of parties as a negation of democracy. This absence of a real choice at the ballot box and the turning over of the presidency to the conservatives, López told American newsmen, may cause the extreme left to turn to violence.
I very much fear that in the long run, this system, if it works out, will cause a crisis in the very first year of the next president. I mean, I believe that if we go back to the democratic procedures and we let those who are in favor of Castro, frankly in favor of Castro, seek the vote on their own ground, I believe that the Castro threat would disappear. But if there is no room for them in the democratic life of Colombia, I very much fear that violence is going to increase.
One of the alternatives facing Colombia if the coalition fails would be the return of a totalitarian movement. In August 1962, Liberal President Leras Camargo will step down and a conservative will take over. Whether this can be accomplished smoothly and peacefully is the test. Meantime, democracy hangs in the balance in Colombia. Observers who are optimistic over the struggle for democracy in Latin America are quick to point to the impressive string of dictators who have been toppled since the end of World War II. Vargas in Brazil, Perón in Argentina, Odría in Peru, Rojas Pinilla in Colombia, Perez Jimenez in Venezuela, Batista in Cuba. And this year saw the 31-year-old dictatorship of Generalissimo Trujillo of the Dominican Republic end in a blaze of machine gun fire. We still must see, of course, whether his son carries out promises of free elections by May of 1962. Thus, only a few old-style dictators still survive in Latin America, the Somoza brothers in Nicaragua, Stroessner in Paraguay, and Duvalier in Haiti. The last days of the Batista dictatorship in Cuba rank among the most cruel and violent of 20th century tyrants in Latin America, save perhaps Trujillo and Perez Jimenez. And so it was natural that Cuban people welcomed the bearded liberators who came down from the Sierra Maestra. The overthrow of the Batista regime may be regarded as unique in the annals of revolution in Latin America. It was one of the few times that a force of armed civilians has defeated a tyrant whose power rested upon a well-equipped army. Thus, at its start, the Castro Revolution appeared to represent a real victory for democracy in Latin America. Later came the sad awakening.
In September of 1959, I came to New York to represent Cuba as delegate to the United Nations, keeping my rank of ambassador. From time to time, during of a year, I went several times to Cuba, and I saw how things were changing from worst to worst.
Dr. Teresa Casuso, a former Castro diplomat, one of about 100,000 Cubans living in the United States in self-imposed exile.
There was no press freedom. The prisons were filled with prisoners. Everything I had defended, I had spoken in universities, in a trip I took all over South America. Everything was torn to pieces and had become a monstrous lie.
Shortly after the abortive invasion of Cuba by a small army of exiles equipped and aided by the United States, Castro described his regime in Cuba as socialist in the Soviet sense of the word. Almost immediately after Castro came to power, tough, zealous, well-paid Castro agents began operations in almost all of Latin America. Their aim, by fomenting riots, labor disputes, spreading communist propaganda, to soften up other countries for takeover by Castro-type governments.
I regard Fidelismo as more dangerous than communism to the interests of the United States in Latin America. For Fidelismo is the most clear-cut expression we have had of the rising tide of continental nationalism, cum populism, a blend made all the more pleasing to many Latin American palates by its strong flavor of anti-imperialism and Yankee phobia, which have flourished again in those countries since the passing of Franklin Roosevelt and his good neighbor policy.
One of the foremost historians of Latin America, University of Pennsylvania Professor Arthur P. Whitaker.
Fidelismo has already aroused a highly favorable response in many Latin American countries, despite the handicap of its communist ties. But I am convinced that the response would be even more favorable if Fidelismo could divest itself of this communist association, which offends the ingrained, almost instinctive continentalism or Latin Americanism felt by most of the people of the countries to the south of us.
Professor Whitaker sees the democratic system of the United States on trial in Latin America, particularly in countries where we have poured in large amounts of money to bail the government out of financial and political troubles. Bolivia is such a country.
Despite a substantial and steady flow of aid from the United States, Bolivia is nevertheless today on the verge of bankruptcy. The ill success of our experiment in Bolivia has fed skepticism in Latin America about the viability there of the whole system, both economic and political, represented by the United States. This skepticism, in turn, has rendered Latin Americans more responsive to one of the two main features of Fidel Castro's type of nationalism, namely, its exaltation of the authoritarian nation-state, which sacrifices freedom to forced draft economic development and social reform.
Castro, as well as the communists, consider members of the democratic left as bitter enemies. One has only to look at Venezuela to see a prime example. There, the extreme left has joined with the extreme right in an attempt to topple the left-of-center government of President Romulo Betancourt. A student of the Liberal Party movement in Latin America, Dr. Harry Cantor, believes the popular democratic parties are stealing the communists' thunder.
One thing about the communist movement is agreed to by everybody who has studied it, and that is that the communist movement has spent a tremendous amount of money in Latin America. For this, they have gotten very little results. The reason that the Communist Party has not had too much success is because in most of the countries of Latin America, indigenous reformist movements have sprung up, which have managed to win the support of the majority of the population. Now, the Communist Party, whose slogan is that it has a monopoly on reform, never admits that any other reformist movement can be on the right track. And therefore, in those countries where these strong reformist movements have sprung up, the communists have allied themselves with the most conservative and reactionary forces in society in an attempt to gain a foothold amongst the masses. Acción Democrática of Venezuela, the National Liberation Party of Costa Rica, the Priesta Movement of Peru. These groups have tried to combine the ideas of European democratic socialism with ideas about what America or Latin America needs to create something new in political ideology. And with the years, they have seemed to grow stronger and stronger in all Latin America.
One of the bright spots in the struggle for democracy in Latin America is located some 15 kilometers outside of San Jose, Costa Rica. There, in a building formerly occupied by a nightclub and restaurant, is what has come to be known as a school for democracy.
The liberal parties of Latin America, with some U.S. friends, have founded in Costa Rica a school for training young political leaders and young labor leaders on the democratic camp. This is a belated effort, but very much needed.
One of the school's founders, Jose Figueres.
We expect to have three groups of 50 boys from all countries living together for 90 days on their intensive course on democracy, on history, on economics, on political organization, and on the democratic labor movement. We hope to enlarge this school. As we get more funds, we will enlarge the groups. These boys from many countries will become an international fraternity of democracy. The fact that they're living together, working together during 90 days under good, sound teachers seems to start a very interesting and vigorous movement for the future. I'm sorry we began so late, but at least we have already started. The first course is already working.
The struggle for democracy in Latin America is not over. Only a few dictatorships remain. However, the picture has been complicated by the introduction of the cult of Fidel Castro, Fidelismo, and by communist inroads. The success of the struggle depends on whether this hemisphere can muster the courage, the spunk, as well as the spiritual strength to meet the new challenge. In any event, the United States must lead the way. Former Foreign Minister of Costa Rica, Gonzalo Facio, sums up the role of the United States in the struggle for democracy in Latin America.
The countries that believe in freedom expect the United States to lead. In the past, the United States didn't exercise at all that leadership. That created a great disappointment. I think that if the trend that has begun to take form during the last year, and that will be increased if President Kennedy is going to live up to what he promised in the campaign, we will have a real strong democratic leadership, and that will be one of the best things to do to improve United States-Latin American relations.
For the past half hour, we've been reporting on the struggle for democracy, a part of the contemporary revolution in Latin America.
The Struggle for Democracy is the third in a series of weekly documentary reports on the contemporary revolution in Latin America. The program is narrated by the distinguished American journalist and editor of the Christian Science Monitor, Irwin D. Cantum. The series is produced in cooperation with the University of Florida's School of Inter-American Studies. You may receive without charge the text of today's program by writing this station. This program was prepared and recorded by Will Lewis for Radio Center, School of Journalism and Communications, University of Florida, Gainesville, under a grant from the National Educational Television and Radio Center, and is being distributed by the National Association of Educational Broadcasters. This is the NAEB Radio Network.